This is Don Hossig with Cancer Action Network. You are listening to Loving the Earth, Pollution Free Revolution. Joining us today is a very important figure in bringing about what we're all hoping for, this huge change upon the earth, basically an environmental revolution, where there wouldn't be any more chemicals in our environment that cause horrible diseases, including cancer. Hey, this is Kelly Franklin. Hi, Kelly. How's it going?
Hello. Hi. Good.
And Kelly is going to tell us about a big part of his life in which he experienced the use of Agent Orange. Most people think of Agent Orange as an herbicide, a defoliant, that was used in the aerial spraying of Vietnam during the Vietnam War. But Kelly is going to help us to become aware of the fact that this has also happened in the North American, on the North American continent. It happened at Canadian Forces Base, Gagetown, and I'll say no more.
Okay. Hi. All right. I was born in 1957, and on my first birthday, my father was transferred to Canadian Forces Base, Gagetown, New Brunswick, and it was only in 2005 that I learned what had happened there. They were spraying Agent Orange from 1956 to 1964, and then they began in 1965 spraying Agent White. And so all that time between the time I was sprayed and when I found out, I had no idea, and neither did my family. So I've been putting this together ever since 2005, doing research, trying to get the big jigsaw puzzle filled in here about just what happened. And I'd like to say right off that we sure haven't been helped, the researching. We haven't been helped by the Canadian government one little bit. They're fighting tooth and nail to keep us from learning what happened there. And the amounts, the effects, everything has been covered up, whitewashed, you name it. It's millions of dollars have been spent on this just to keep people from finding out. So
so what chemicals were they that make up these various agents, you know, that are lumped together oftentimes as Agent Orange?
Okay, there were about, from my reckoning, there were about 40 different chemicals altogether, but the main ones are called 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T and picloram. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes.
And, okay, so 2,4-D and picloram make up Agent White. That was by far the most prevalent chemical agent sprayed on Gagetown. And the other one, of course, is Agent Orange, which is 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. So they started in 1956, as I said, spraying.
And tell me, why? Why did they, what was the purpose of the spraying?
Okay, well, in 1952, Canada was talked into opening up a very, very large military base by the U.S., so that we could, in part, fulfill our NATO obligations and also to assist the USA. So they expropriated a large parcel of land in New Brunswick, but it was covered in forest, darn it. And so they decided to use their newest toy, which were the chemical weapons called Agent Orange and Agent White, to get rid of those forests. They did it rather creatively, too. They actually burned down the forest in some areas so that they left areas of forest which were only observable from the air as figures, like our national symbol, the maple leaf, is actually observable from the air in CFB Gagetown right this day.
It's quite a, you know, they were quite, oh, how creative they can be, you know, when they're you know, there's a certain almost intelligence and imaginativeness to that. I can see how it would have an appeal to, like, you know, have the main symbol of Canada be part of a military operation.
Yeah.
But wow, what havoc they wrecked with their little creative, you know, behaviors. Tell me, let's continue on with the matter of what happened, but don't let me end this interview without me asking you why you think there is so much resistance to your learning about this. But let's just say that for a minute here. We'll both remember to get into that. go on about how much was sprayed, like any quantities that would be relevant to our discussion here?
Yes. Okay. This is I'm going to have to be dilate on this quite a bit because, well, like I say, we're not being given the documents that we need.
Right.
We've heard of documents that say much more than we've seen, but as far as I know, from 56 to 64, about 250,000 gallons of Agent Orange were sprayed on the base. After that, I'm trying to put this in not using metric terms, too, because,
right.
Well, I don't even think that way, but from starting in 65, there were millions of pounds and many hundreds of thousands of gallons of 2,4-D and picloram sprayed on the base. There's a bit of difficulty in giving you one figure of how much was sprayed because we're talking about liquid and solid pesticides. And, one person tried, and they came up with 1 billion grams. I don't know what that means to any of your listeners, but it doesn't really...
Doesn't mean a lot to me.
No, it doesn't nail it for me either, but it's a lot.
If it was 1 billion grams of dioxin, that would be absolutely an international, a planetary, an earth-wide catastrophe. I suspect it wasn't 1 billion grams of dioxin, but, well, who knows? Maybe it is. That's a lot. Those other numbers you were quoting are very, very large.
Yes.
And truly, the dioxin contaminant back in the old days, back at that time when that version of the 245T was being produced by Dow Monsanto, that was very heavily contaminated. It was a considerable fraction of the total that was actually this 2,478 tetrachlorobenzopyridoxin, the most
yes.
toxic of the dioxins.
Yes. Canada made 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D for direct exportation to Vietnam during the Vietnam War, by the way.
Okay.
So
what companies were producing it up there?
We have subsidiaries of Dow and Monsanto, plus there were other companies here as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some toxic sites just like around your Dow plant and...
Yeah, it's interesting. Tomorrow at about a little earlier than this, we're going to start an hour earlier, I'm interviewing this Michelle Hurd Reddick from Midland, Michigan, who's going to be speaking to me about what Dow has wrought and how they continue to contaminate and poison and, keep this pollution in the environment there on the Tittabawassee and the Saginaw Rivers. It's horrible.
Absolutely. Yes.
Wow. And then they didn't tell them. They told them about that 4 years earlier than they told you guys about this up there at Gagetown.
Yep.
It was in 2001 when the state of Michigan started to make it known to the residents of those rivers that they were in very hot zones.
Yep, and then they fired your, what was her name, Wade of the EPA? They fired her because she was trying to push Dowd into cleaning up the place. And
I've heard a little about this, but see, you probably know more about this than I do. By tomorrow... I'll probably be catching up a bit, but I'm not familiar with it. It's amazing. I live in New York State. I probably don't live any more than, say, 400 miles from where this occurred. Live right on a major river, the St. Lawrence River, which certainly had plenty of Dow dioxin come down it because of this chemical going into Lake Huron and then being part of the Great Lakes Basin. But I had never heard of this matter until maybe a year ago, something like that. And then I started just gradually investigating it, putting these together, finding contacts, and it all it's come together very, truly the Agent Orange Working Group. I want to say something positive, positive, positive about that particular entity because I have learned so much about the details of where and when and what adverse effects have resulted from being on that Agent Orange Working Group.
Yes.
And it truly, I have to say, just Dr. Arnold Schechter got me interested in joining that, and I want to say thanks to Arnold Schechter and the Agent Orange Working Group for, making truly, this is why I'm interviewing you today. I would not have known a thing about any of this. Never spoken to you probably in my life,
if
I hadn't gotten that working group. It's so powerful the way these working groups work.
Yes. Okay. Just as a kind of an analogy about how much they sprayed in Gagetown, I come up with one thing. I did a calculation on the amounts, and then I compared it with what was sprayed, what's known to have been sprayed in Vietnam, and the amount of dioxin in particular was calculated for Vietnam as what was it, several hundred kilograms. And I compared it with Gagetown, and I came up with the amounts per acre were 2 to 2.5 times in Gagetown what it was in Vietnam. So I've heard independently that the base, Gagetown, is a hot spot, every much as Da Nang, Vietnam, is, that the well, place is dirty. And we've seen well, results, chemical analysis of the soil and sediment, that say that the area is hundreds of times above the limits set internationally and in Canada.
Sure.
But, this has all been covered up. They actually disallowed those results and sent the more samples back for further evaluation, is how they put it. And then the base commander was fired. So
well, that number, the quantity per acre, is certainly very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
Because say in the total of all the spraying over this huge country of Vietnam,
yeah,
of course there will be more having been sprayed there because it's such a larger area. But the relevant matter is how much is sprayed per any one unit of surface. So if you guys have had more sprayed per acre than what they had sprayed, it certainly is very important to kind of keep on top of that aspect of this, and that matter also of testing the soil to actually see just how high the levels are of the dioxins. That's where it really gets into the most important of all information, because that is really what determines how much ongoing exposure there will be for anyone that, say, eats wild game from around there, or
mm-hmm.
fishes and eats fish, or who, you know, just even breathes around there and having this off-gassing from the soil. There's very many ways, and people tracking dirt into their houses and that becoming part of the dust in the house and then breathing that dust. These are certainly all very significant exposure routes for people in places that actually have a serious dioxin contamination problem.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but it is actually worse than that. Every year, CFB Gagetown conducts an annual burn, and they burn everything they've killed the previous year. So this, of course, sends up an enormous plume of released dioxin, because that isn't destroyed at the temperatures of a fire.
Yep.
It takes hundreds and hundreds of degrees Celsius to kill or to destroy dioxin. It's very hardy.
Well, how do they get away with doing that?
It's Department of Defense, Department of National Defense in Canada, and they have carte blanche. They can do anything they want.
I'm amazed that the residents haven't just taken up arms and just, you know, do a little, we're kind of slight, maybe, I don't know, maybe us Americans are just a little more into that type of thing. You know, I oftentimes, you know, feel like that I would never be willing to go along with this matter of the citizenry giving up their arms, because I think that is oftentimes necessary as we proceed along the path of being human beings.
Yep.
And wow, if that was happening, believe me, if they were doing that down at Fort Drum, see, down at Fort Drum, you know, we have this army base down there, and it did use dioxin some. We should investigate how much they used.
Yes.
Truly. You know, maybe they used a lot there, too. I always kind of felt like, well, they just tested a little bit. You know, you always try to put the best face on this. We know they used dioxin to test it, so to speak, for use in Vietnam. That's the story.
Yep.
And it was used there at Fort Drum. Fort Drum was only about, I'd say it was about 40, 50 miles from where I'm at, the way the crow flies. And we do. There are occasional forest fires there because, see, it gets very dry here, and it's sandy there, and it dries out, and they have this range, they call it, where they do live ammunition testing. And so when they're dropping these bombs, they start these fires, and then the fires burn. And then I've smelled the smoke. It comes as far as here in my part of the Adirondacks. I've smelled it for days on end sometimes. And see, there was another problem with Fort Drum. They tested the depleted uranium shells. And so oftentimes I've heard people raise this matter of, you know, just how much exposure are we getting over here in the San Lawrence River Valley when these fires are burning on Fort Drum, and they use the DU, and you know, nobody even knows about, really thinks about the dioxin all that much.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the DU. So you telling me that they're burning this place deliberately, Fort Drum was very apologetic about not getting these fires put out. They would never have dared try to do any deliberate burning down there, I'll tell you.
Right. No, it's an annual event here. Just as a sidebar here on DU, I've got a newspaper article from a Cub reporter and who was covering an event at Gagetown in the 80s, and he described how a couple of, I can't remember the actual designation, but you call them warthogs, type of airplane that has like a Gatling gun or a couple of guns. Anyway, they came over the horizon and they vaporized, I think was the term, a couple of target tanks. I don't mean like water tanks. I mean, you know, these were military tanks.
Right.
And they were using DU. And this is in Gagetown.
Huh. Well, they spread plenty of that around. And the problem with that is the DU, you know, dioxins certainly last for a very long time in the environment. That's why they call it a persistent organic pollutant, one of the many. But the difference between how long DU lasts, you know, the uranium lasts, and the radioactivity, the cancer risk-imposing exposure, the difference between the length of time that lasts and how long dioxin lasts is a huge amount. It's almost forever as far as kind of like the matters of human existence are concerned. How long the radioactive uranium will be in these places once the DU has been used. And I felt just so negative, so angry, truly, toward our government and our, you know, our military for using Agent Orange in Vietnam and how long that was going to last and how horrible, you know, that all turned out. But then this DU thing, and we're just beginning to investigate this and try to take part in bringing that to an end, you know, the use of that horrible, you know, chemical weapon to an end. It's just, I am so just without, I don't know what really to do to truly express my disapproval of our military using the depleted uranium in the Middle East. It's just to think that those places have now become poisoned forever. Oh, it's just...
Yeah, no, as a guinea pig of one of the adventures of the USA, well, Canada sure helped in there, I got to agree with you that all this stuff has got to stop because it looks like we're heading to nuclear pretty in the near future here with Iran, and we're sure keeping a close eye on all that up here, I'll tell you. I think we're more worried than Americans about that one. But, well, just to get back to the Agent Orange here, in 65, okay, and this dwarfs what happened from 56 to 64. They started spraying Agent White, and this is also known as Tordon 101, one of the fine products of Dow. And I've actually got an article by two Monsanto scientists slamming Agent White, Tordon 101, saying that it's how toxic it is, that it shouldn't be used in Vietnam. This is during the Vietnam War that this was published. Here they were using it in Gagetown en masse. As I said, it was millions of pounds, hundreds of thousands of gallons, and you can see CFP Gagetown from space. Let me put it that way. If you get up Google Earth and you punch in CFP Gagetown, it can be viewed from space. It's a scar surrounded by green forests. That's the scale. And one of the other reasons that they made for using this much defoliant was that they do live fire practice there as well. And they wanted to reduce the incidence of forest fires, even though they burn the place every year. So that's just one of the other excuses that they use. But to me, there's no excuse for that amount that they use. They inundated the place. And, I mean, I've got maps showing what they sprayed when. And they were spraying Agent Purple, Agent Orange, Agent White, just blocks from my house. Because they did the perimeter of the base so that the fence could be seen. And we're talking very close, using fixed-wing aircraft, which is not a precision instrument back in those days. So one of the reasons I think that more people aren't up in arms that live around Gagetown is I think many of them are dead. We don't have terrific medical information because, as I said, this has all been covered up. But there are places that they call Widow's Row around Gagetown that it's they're just decimated. There are no people there except for the widows of the men who actually were in the ranges and training area, which is, you know, where they did the most spraying of Gagetown.
Just as far as getting one other detail of what occurred, what's basically, a ballpark figure, the size of this place, how big an area was sprayed, kind of a ballpark figure?
Base Gagetown was the largest camp of its type in the Commonwealth up until 1971, and then they opened another one in Suffield in Canada, which is even larger. But I'll try to stay away from the metric figures. It's 1,100 square kilometers, which translates to, 449 square miles.
Well, that's pretty big.
Yeah, it's
How many miles would be across it, just to even for... Because sometimes square miles, it's kind of confusing to people, they don't really think that clearly in square miles. How many miles would be across it,
60 tall by... 50 miles high by about 40 some wide. It's twice as big as Prince Edward Island. Let me put it that. Not Prince Edward Island. Montreal Island, where Montreal, the city of Montreal, is.
Yep.
Yeah, it's twice as big as that island. So
it's a big place. Our county, our St. Lawrence County.
Yeah.
It's probably someplace in that ballpark because I'm thinking. You're saying 60 north and south and 40 east and west.
Roughly, yeah.
That's closing in. Our county might be a little taller than that. Maybe ours is about 90, 90 each way. It's kind of this big cube, this big square-shaped thing in some certain way. It's right along the St. Lawrence River, We're right south of the St. Lawrence River, the part of New York State that's bordering the St. Lawrence River. That's St. Lawrence County.
Yes.
And we're downwind from Fort Drum. With the, the old Agent Orange use and the continuing, I'm not going to say continuing, but the more recent DU use. And we're placed 40 miles from there, as I said. We're not truly all that far from you. And the strange thing is, I just love the wilds. And I had oftentimes thought about wanting to travel up to New Brunswick because there's this aspect of New Brunswick, which I find particularly appealing, and it is the fact that it's believed by lots of some of these kind of wildlife experts that some of the remaining mountain lions of the eastern North America have persisted in New Brunswick. And so I always thought, boy, it'd be cool to go up there and hang out and be in the forests of New Brunswick and seek these mountain lions, which I've heard reports of them being here in the Adirondacks. I know people that have seen them. I have never seen one myself, but I certainly would love to see one in the east. In fact, I've never even seen one in the west, and I've spent some time out there not really looking hard for them. But I've certainly had plans of traveling up to New Brunswick and seeking these mountain lions that are supposed to exist there.
Yeah.
And boy, now, and I'll tell you, one other thing that it was a chemical matter as well. Truly, probably what has prevented me from visiting New Brunswick, before I even learned of this problem that New Brunswick has, was the use of that spray they do for the spruce budworm.
Yes.
That just seemed to me, when I heard that huge areas of the New Brunswick forest were sprayed with chemicals to kill these spruce budworms, I thought, well, there's a place I definitely don't want to go.
Yep. No, that was started in 1952. And in some ways, that actually dwarfs even what I'm talking about with the chemical weapons. But a lot of that was insecticide,
Yeah, do you know what particular insecticide was used for that?
I've looked it up, and I don't even think I can pronounce them. There were several different...
Is it a carcinogen?
Yes, they're all toxic. They were killing the salmon. I think that Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring, actually did something about on the use of this stuff in New Brunswick at the time. I don't have a reference for you, but...
Well, tell me. Does the spruce budworm spraying continue?
I don't know.
Okay.
It may. It wouldn't surprise me because they were just given, when it comes to whether is it going to be trees or people, they chose the trees every time.
This is the problem we are running into. That just say that again.
Well, dollars or death. They chose the trees over the people in every case when it came down to a choice.
See, we experience this every day here in the United States. We're very similar, Canadians and Americans, in our values. We have found over and over and over again that what is the determining matter, you know, when it comes down to people are arguing about something, people are trying to make up their mind about something, something's going to change, something's going to stay the same, a decision's going to be made. When the matters of making money are kind of involved with, basically in conflict with, to a degree, that they're an alternative. Making money is an alternative to having health or having a clean environment or even not getting cancer. The matters of money oftentimes, if not nearly always, and to a very large extent always, they are the ones that decide. You know, they're the ones that are that win. You know, it's, say, I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
Here in New York State, for a very long time, since way back like in the probably 60s, 70s, 80s, I grew up with it. I'm 54, and so I was born in 1955. And, you know, when we were growing up on a farm, we had over in the St. Lawrence River Valley, in the township of Lisbon, right on the St. Lawrence River, you know, that township.
Yes.
We would burn our trash. You know, we would get, you know, the plastic that was gradually becoming a bigger part of the waste stream. We'd have, like, these various things from the supermarket, you know, the different boxes and papers and plastics and metals and foils and, you know, all the mix. You know, we didn't burn the tin cans and the glass because we just, you know, it's not going to burn, and we didn't want to lay it around. So we took that to the landfill.
Yep.
But as far as anything that could be burned and basically just turned into ash, you know, pretty just basically, you know, really reduce the volume a lot and not have a whole lot left laying around, we would take that out on the fence line, make a big pile of it, burn it.
Yep.
Well, we gradually, I started thinking about these things. I hated that smell. It was horrible. And then I went to college in biology and chemistry, and I became more understanding of chemical exposure and, you know, just beginning to start sensing that this was wrong. It was a mistake to do it. So we gradually began to be more like these environmental activists, and I eventually became a very strong environmental activist and had these environmental groups. And we focused on this trash burning. And you would be amazed to know how many times when I was discussing the need with our local government, state government, national government people to bring an end to this practice, and even with everyday common, you know, just the average American citizenry, you know, members of the public, how many times this matter of, but the farmers, they need this option of getting rid of their trash by burning it. They can't, it's very hard to make a living as a farmer. They need to be able to, you know, get rid of this trash to be able to make money cheap. Get rid of the trash cheap, burn it on the farm. And so people here, in this case, even though it was this widely recognized source of dioxins,
yep,
this horrible thing to do on a farm in particular, because then the concentrated emissions were right there where the food is, contaminating that, whether it be animal food or the food of animals, you know, food for animals like corn, hay, alfalfa, these forage crops were being raised on the farm. When they burn this trash right there and it contaminates these foods, then the cows eat it, then it's part of our food supply.
Yes.
But so many times people hesitated to move forward with bringing an end to this trash burning, totally because of the concern about making money. And it was amazing. What was even worse than all these entities I mentioned previously, the New York State Farm Bureau, one of the largest, you know, this well-established membership organization of farmers, they were so comfortable with the argument of making the money that in public they would publicly lobby our New York State legislature to not ban this trash burning. And there were laws proposed for years and years and years, and our New York State legislature was never successful in banning this practice by law. The only way this practice has begun to be reduced in activity level, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, they passed a regulation which banned this trash burning practice.
Good.
And it was all because the difficulty, it took years. I spent 12 years of my life just getting that ban that DEC passed in October 14th of 2009. It was just recently passed, just about a year ago. You know, in fact, this is the 13th. Tomorrow's a happy, you know, anniversary of that,
yeah,
final ban on this trash burning.
Yes.
And I was driving up in Ontario, and they're still doing it up there. I talked to the Ontario Ministry of Environment people, their ag police, that deal with agricultural issues and the environment, and they said, nope, it's still legal up here.
Yep. Yeah, you go to lots of those little lakes up in northern Ontario, and there's big signs saying, do not fish. Oh, the fish are poisoned. I'm glad, and I'm also a little bit concerned about New York, for your chemical entities, because in a few years, I don't think it's going to take very long, you're going to start seeing some drastically different statistics on cancer. And this is probably going to be a big black eye for these companies when they realize that you can trace it to the banning of burning, for instance, the lessening of the dioxin that's available is going to... good for you. I sure wish they'd do it here, though.
Oh, we had to work so hard at that.
We
found some farmers that were good-hearted and good-intentioned, and they were willing to just agree with us that this was wrong and it should be brought to an end. And we gradually worked with town boards and just got them to show their disapproval of this. And actually, the town of Canton, which is our county seat here in St. Lawrence County, they were willing to ban this practice on their own in their township before the state did the ban. And I'm sure that helped a lot, you know.
Yes,
and we went around to a lot of different towns, and we didn't find a single other town. No, I take that back. I think the town of Madrid also banned the practice. There were a few towns that we went to that were willing to ban it before the state did their regulatory ban. But it was so shocking to me, and like you say, you know, this is the whole problem. For some reason, our countries, you know, Canada and the U.S., in particular, like making money. You know, we are so in love with the concept of people making lots of money and making money, you know, just to make money and just to have a lot of money, to have things, that we will ignore every aspect of the outcome of the making of the money.
Yes.
It's absolutely outrageous.
Yeah.
I think this is the biggest change that needs to take place in our civilization, you know, that these powerful countries like Canada and the U.S. would change their mind about the all-overarching, the all-important, the all-dominant matter of that making, you know, this making of money. You know, that people would change and think, well, making money isn't as important as having good health. You know, I say to people every day, I say, we'd be better off all poor than having cancer.
Yep, yeah.
And they say, well, you know, you're right.
I really can't think of any better example of this than Canada itself. And I mean, we made some outrageous, immoral decisions in the 50s by allowing, the collaboration with the U.S. in testing all these chemical warfare weapons in Gagetown. And then during the Vietnam War, we made a mint, billions, in making and selling bombs, ammunition, aircraft parts, you name it, for directly to the prosecution of the Vietnam War. Something I'd like to mention here about that, though, is that in my investigation, I was looking at what was sprayed in Gagetown by year and then comparing it with what was sprayed in Vietnam.
Yep.
By year, and lo and behold, they're the same list. They're exactly the same. Everything that was sprayed on Gagetown later was sprayed on Vietnam during the Vietnam War in exactly the same order. So that's when I realized, it was quite an epiphany for me, because that's when I realized, hey, Canada was collaborating with the USA in field testing all the weapons, the chemical weapons later deployed during the Vietnam War. And that also explains why the amounts, they were really, you know, they were proving the effectiveness of these. And then they'd come back in a few months and say, hey, that worked. Let's spray this on Vietnam, which is exactly what they, you know, they did. Because I've got documents showing, well, let's take 1963, for instance. There was a colonel in the U.S. Army's Chemical Corps running the crop destruction missions in Vietnam in May of 1963. And then in December of 63, he's in Gagetown advising what to spray the following year in 1964. And, they took his advice. And 1964 saw one of the biggest that I've ever been able to find spray drift accidents in maybe the world. I don't know. It was 25 kilometers, I'm sorry, that's another metric figure. What's that, about 18 miles wide. It was rather circular, and all the farms and market gardens in that diameter of an area around Gagetown were killed. And the Crown had to pay $250,000 in compensation to all the farmers, which was an enormous amount of money in 1964 when you think of a bunch of tomatoes and carrots and stuff, right? But the damage that was caused was actually described in newspaper articles at the time as that the tomatoes, in for instance, were cracked, were dried, desiccated. And, well, that's not what happens with Agent Orange. I think it was the biggest test of Agent Blue, which was specifically designed to kill crops in Vietnam, that maybe the world has ever seen. And they laid it on thick on Gagetown just to prove it. And then they told everybody, oh, it's safe to eat. You know, it's okay. Here's some money. And yet, well, that contains arsenic. It's a proven carcinogen. And
yes.
So there's one.
So the Agent Blue contains arsenic as well as some of these other chemicals?
That was the major constituent of it. No, it doesn't contain 2,4-D or 2,5-T.
Okay, mainly arsenic.
Yeah.
That's very powerful to know.
Yeah.
My dad was he was in World War II in the Navy, but before he went and after he went, he worked at an apple orchard, and they used the arsenic of lead a lot. And I've always felt he was very, very fortunate to not develop the cancer because of both the lead and arsenic being human carcinogens. And they used it so much, his clothing would just be so saturated with it, the coveralls would, you know, just stand right up in the corner. So saturated with these arsenic and lead that they were so stiffened by the amount of the metals in the fabric. The coveralls, you'd just stand them right against the wall. They stand right up.
That's the same anecdote that many of the widows have told me about their husbands' uniforms when they came in from the ranges and training area after the spraying, that their husbands were so saturated in this stuff that just what you said. It's pretty amazing. And then, of course, the wives would wash the uniforms with all the kids' clothes and everything and spread it around.
So did that happen in your house?
Yes.
Well,
yeah, I remember helping my mother do the wash, and then we'd hang it on the line. This is way back. But we think that many of the wives, even though they weren't, let's say, directly sprayed, were either contaminated through spray drift from the eating of the either wild game or there were dairy farms around the base. And as you probably know, when a cow ingests, you know, what it's eating, it takes up a certain amount of dirt every day, too. I think it was like half a kilogram per cow, which would contain TCDD because it binds with organic matter.
Yep.
So we were all getting it through milk, meat, and the game. I've got a picture of my father holding up a fish he had just caught on Gagetown, and that was our supper.
Well, this thing of washing the clothes that are saturated in these chemicals, that's a huge exposure route there. You know, they probably, many cases, I've often thought that maybe the women got exposed more than the men just because of working with all those clothes so closely, you know, putting those clothes in the washing machine and taking them out and handling all that over and over and over and over again. And just, they got a lot of exposure. There's no doubt about that.
Yes. No, I agree.
Wow. I wonder if people will ever learn from these bad experiences and change and be a little more careful with chemicals. I don't see this happening. When you think about it, truly the DU seems to me more dangerous than the Agent Orange. It certainly does last longer, and it's certainly very, very potent as a cancer causer. And it certainly does get spread around and stay there. It seems like everything I can think about that is of concern with the dioxin in the Agent Orange is of greater concern with the, you know, the uranium in the DU. It just seems like there's no learning going on.
No.
And that gives me reason to wonder what we should really be doing. You know, talking is the way people deal with things in this kind of learning-based mode of change. I certainly hope that somehow our talking and other people's talking will lead out of these, you know, these quagmires and these abysses that we have descended into on a regular basis. And I feel a lot of compassion for you guys, because my big exposures to chemicals were, we were farmers. We weren't big farmers, thank God.
Yeah.
My dad was a veterinarian, and so we were small farmers to get along, just because we wanted to do it. We chose to do it out of just as a pleasure, really. But we kind of overdid it. We had about 40 head of cattle at times. And we would, because of the long winters and the having the cattle in the barns, they would get mange and lice. And I certainly have had, you know, I never had my clothes so saturated with these chemicals that they would, you know, just stand up stiff against the wall.
Yeah.
But that might just have been a difference in the chemistry that was going on, you know, what was being applied, because I used chlordane, which is a very potent human carcinogen.
Yeah.
I used chlordane a considerable amount on cattle, you know, back in my teens and probably early 20s even, because we had our dairy cattle and our beef cattle, and they would have these lice and mange on them. And the way especially to deal with the mange was to use the chlordane. And I wish I hadn't done it, but I didn't know any better back those days.
Yeah. No, I remember, this is when I was very young, they used to spray Maathion from Jeeps going down the residential streets to kill the mosquitoes. And it would be a thick fog, and all of us kids would chase the trucks because it was, you know, a novel game. And there we'd be inhaling all this crap. But that's what they did on military bases in those days. They to keep the soldiers operational, let's say, at least for the short term, because they needed to be. Everything was about being deployable, and they didn't really care about your health 10, 20, 30 years down the line. Not at all.
How horrible.
Ghastly,
you know, how unfortunate you were to be a part of a system where human beings were there being kept, like you say, deployable, when there were mosquitoes to take into account and these different things, so they just kill them and just keep the people out there active, normally active, and yet, wow, what a cost, you know, breathing and being exposed to all these pesticides that would kill the mosquitoes, and then all the herbicides. You know, they were making this place a big open place where you could drive around in with some equipment, and then burning the stuff and breathing the smoke from that. And, well, your father and your mother and you kids all certainly did have a lot of chemicals get into your bodies that you didn't know anything about and would not have chosen to have in your body if you had known anything about it.
No. I discovered the existence of a half-brother of mine just very recently. And I was talking with him, and he told me that he was born with a couple of birth defects right after that. He was conceived right after that 1964, what I suspect was an Agent Blue field test. And he was born in 65 when they started the spraying of Agent White. And he was born with the birth defect of having no musculature in one of his calves and cardiovascular anomalies, because he's had strokes and heart attacks. And he's much younger than me. Like, I'm 52. And so, you know, there's all that in there that, yeah. And we didn't know. He didn't know until I told him in 2010, let me put it that way, that he was exposed to. And certainly my father never knew. He died in 1996 after being sick for 20 years. And he had all the diseases that American Vietnam vets get.
Right,
and but we had no idea. I mean, we couldn't tell his doctors. Oh, he received a massive dose of 2,3-7-8 dioxin or TCDD, and maybe that would have made some difference. Maybe they could have done something. But as a matter of fact, when my father died, our doctors asked to do an autopsy on him because his case was so unusual that he had so many things wrong with him. And unfortunately, my mother said no, but. If I had known now what I knew, you know, if I had known then what I know now, I would have pushed for that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's truly the harm. There was a certain amount of harm that was caused by doing this, you know, by doing the spraying and having people involved right around there and being immersed in it and doing it and being there working and doing their military activities. There was a certain amount of harm caused by that. But
great deal.
Then the amount of harm that was caused by not telling people what was known about what happened until so very recently, to have had such a long period go by of these uninformed people of having had that exposure, there was a lot more harm caused.
That was the greatest evil in my mind. You know, if they had come to me in, let's say, 1969, 1970 or whatever, and said, Kelly, you know, I'm sorry, we made a terrible mistake, and you were sprayed with chemical warfare weapon Agent Orange. Here's $5,000, you know, sorry. I would have accepted it and said, well, you know, gee, it was in defense of our nation or something, you know, to rationalize it. But that they kept it, almost used an expletive there, a secret all this time. And now they're fighting us like you wouldn't believe in the courts. We've been trying to get our case certified even as a class action in Canada, and we've been fighting for 5 years without success because when we initiated this in 2005, Canada's first action was to make Dow and Monsanto their co-defendants. So whenever we try to do anything in court, there's this wall of lawyers.
Right,
and they do every dirty trick and legal finagle that they can think of. They're even challenging Canada's class action laws in court right now, just to throw a wrench into everything.
Right, that's the way it works. There are a million ways in which people can obfuscate and cause things to go on and on and on forever, because life is complicated and the legal system is complicated. And these lawyers, they're brilliant. They're evil, but they're brilliant. And of course, they can come up with maneuvers. You prolong this, prolonging is the plan, is the order of the day. You know, that's all they can hope for, prolonging.
Well, if I can ask your listeners here, if anybody knows of any way that we can take these guys down, now's the time to come out and tell us. You got a document that really proves all this, and you know, we can take out Dow and Monsanto right now, you know, with our class action if we can get it certified. Because they're at great risk right now. Yeah.
So, and when you say a document that can prove this, prove what?
Well, that they knew that 2378 TCDD was in their product in the early 50s. That'd be real nice because the earliest I can find is like 1957. And that...
as far as my awareness of this goes,
yes,
I was hearing, and so I'm behind you, and later than you. What my understanding of the use of these chemicals and the growing knowledge that it was harmful because of the presence of the TCDD, it was my understanding, and I do not know very much about this, so I'm sure that there's probably, you know, an earlier awareness than what I'm aware of. I was thinking that certainly sometime during the Vietnam War, they knew that the dioxin was in the product and they should not have been using it.
Yep.
That's what I know about.
Yep. They sent out samples to a lab in the U.S., I think it was in 65, and then they sat on the results when it came back that it was teratogenic. And they sat on that until 1969, and that's when it really became known. And I'd like to add that they continued spraying it in Vietnam even after that happened, that it was phased out, Agent Orange.
Yep.
And that's when they really
yep.
started spraying Agent White because it was considered to be less toxic. Although one of the constituents of Agent White is 2,4-D, which contains its own types of dioxin, which are pretty toxic, as well as that picloram, which contains hexachlorobenzene, which is one of the dirty dozen that's slated for worldwide elimination. It's a very toxic, maybe even more toxic than 2378 TCDD. I'm not sure. But
well, the hexachlorobenzene is certainly, it's a persistent pollutant. You know, it lasts a long time in the environment.
Yep.
It's carcinogenic in humans and animals. It's got a lot of, you know, deleterious elements, you know, to its, you know, its chemical composition and what it does when people and animals are exposed to it. I've always felt concerned about hexachlorobenzene.
Yeah.
And even some of the other chlorinated benzenes. Wow, we've covered a lot of ground. What do you think? Do you want to wrap this up now and then get into, we're going to do two interviews. We're going to have a Canadian Forces Gagetown 1 and a Canadian Forces Base Gagetown 2.
Lovely.
And our first section, you know, our first interview here has been all about what happened.
Yeah.
And we've started getting into some of the health effects. Let's wrap this up. Tell us one health effect that you are, you know, remembering, and you know, it's some little story about some health effect that has occurred because of this, or that you attribute to this, and then we'll stop, and then we'll do our next hour on the more the health effects, and then get into the lawsuit and all the various and any kind of activism, any kind of like stories you have about how individual people. Say people in your family or people in the, you know, that still live there in Gagetown. It's my understanding that you've moved from there.
Yes.
Suppose that was a very good plan. Anybody that's still left around there that's still, you know, alive after having gone through all that, if they're starting to stand up and, you know, take an active role in getting some accountability from government and some, you know, some fairness and some justice at the, you know, this late date in this. Let's say that for the next time we talk. So, is there any particular instance of a health effect that you attribute to the exposure to all these chemicals that were sprayed there?
Yes. The one that stands out very, very starkly to me, I'll use her first name, Nancy, was born in CFB Gagetown, and she was exposed to both Agent Orange and Agent White. Grew up, started a family, didn't know anything, you know, that was sprayed there. She wasn't aware that she was contaminated, so her and her husband tried to have a family, and she was having trouble with that, so they went for in vitro fertilization. And now I believe that 8 eggs were produced from this, and she had 3 of them implanted, and the rest were frozen. And then she had twins and another child, all born with birth defects. And in the meantime, unfortunately, and this is still before she knew what she had been exposed to, she donated her remaining eggs to people who were completely unable to conceive. So this is a little pocket description of horror to me, that some poor people that were unable to conceive got Nancy's eggs, and you know, they ended up in the same situation we are, and that's again because the Canadian government kept this a secret.
So many things like that right there. That right there is a perfect example of how if the information had been shared in a timely manner, you know, long before that stage of the game, that Nancy would not have donated those eggs, she probably would have chosen to adopt somebody rather than risk bringing somebody into the world to suffer horribly for their whole existence.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, well, look at how many soldiers as well have given blood. We've maybe spread this throughout the population because it's lipophilic. It attaches to fat in any kind of bodily fluid, and here we were giving it away. So, I don't know about how big that was, but just as a footnote to that story about Nancy, there was a British soldier stationed to CFB Gagetown as part of they sent thousands of soldiers to CFB Gagetown every year. And this man went back home and developed the same illness that Nancy later developed, where they had to remove part of the intestines. And so he was there at the same time as Nancy, although Nancy's a Canadian citizen, was born there, yet he received the gold-plated pension for Agent Orange exposure in CFP Gagetown. And Nancy she's treated worse than the Vietnamese are treated by the U.S. government, let me put it that way, because Canada refuses to even acknowledge. They didn't deny everything that, well, I think you've read Canada's statement of defense on this matter, that everything, it's a very simple document to sum up. They denied everything.
Well, let's stop right here.
Yeah.
It's good. Seems like a good place to stop on this kind of doleful note of the Canadian government's bad record. And we'll talk about this next week, and we'll go all the way to the end on this, as far as, you know, the current state of affairs, as far as, you know, what you and the people of Gagetown and anyone else who are allies with you are doing to cause the Canadian government and the U.S. government and these chemical companies to be responsible and somehow try to set, it's impossible to set it right. It cannot be set right. But just to do something to, you know, make it less of a horrible experience for
an inquiry, a full inquiry. That's what we want.
That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
So we'll start up with that the next time we speak.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Kelly, for
Thank you, Mr.
sharing your time like this. You are on a mission, and it is certainly a very honorable and very necessary mission. And I wish you all the best of luck, because I sense you are this. We have this thing. We call them environmental detectives. And some of the environmental detectives are cancer detectives. And we are, you know, myself and the other members of our group, we consider ourselves to be these, you know, we like to think of ourselves as these honorable cancer detectives.
Yes.
And you certainly are a major honorable cancer detective, Kelly.
I agree. Yes.
Yep. Well, thank you so much, and we will talk later.
That'd be great. Okay, thanks.
Yep. Have a great day.
Okay, bye.
Yeah, bye.